This is the 1964 album Beatles for Sale, and like every other early Beatles album, it's full of love songs. But there's one song written by John Lennon that's very different.
Although I laugh and I act like a clown, beneath this mask I am wearing a frown.
It was the first time that John had written about his own life, which, as Paul McCartney later put it, was a cry for help. To the outside world, they were the most famous stars on the planet. Every record they released went straight to number one, and every concert was a mass hysteria of screaming fans. But on the inside, especially for John, things weren't as perfect as they seemed, something that he made even clearer on the next album. Something was clearly not right, and these were John's attempt to tell the world.
I mean, I go into these troughs every few years. It was less noticeable in the Beatles because the Beatles' image and thing would carry you through it, you know. I mean, I was in the middle of a trough in Help, you know, but you can't see it really. I mean, I'm singing Help for a kickoff, you know.
John was clearly struggling, and in the whirlwind of Beatlemania, it seemed difficult to see how this could possibly get better. But thankfully, the same month that Help was recorded, something happened that would change his life forever. It was a spring evening in 1965, and John Lennon and George Harrison were attending a dinner party hosted by a friend. Just before they were about to leave, the host insisted that John and George had a cup of coffee laced with a new drug.
He was saying, I advise you not to go. He didn't know what it was. It was just a sort of, you know, it's all the thing, and they didn't know it was different from pot or pills.
Without either of them knowing, they'd just been given LSD. And now John and George were about to experience their first acid trip, completely unintentionally.
Some of the time, it just felt normal, like as though everything was okay. And then before you knew where you were, suddenly it was all crazy.
They all left the party in George's Mini and made their way over to a nightclub in central London.
You know, we were just insane. I mean, we just had our heads and people had come up to me. We got in the lift and we all thought there was a fire in the lift. It was just a little red light.
And then we got out to the top and everything was okay. And I suppose and we sat there probably for hours and hours. I ended up driving everybody home. It was like daylight.
John later described the experience as both terrifying and fantastic. It was the first time that any of the Beatles had taken LSD, a before and after moment. And just like that, John Lennon saw the world in a completely different way.
So when acid came around, we'd heard that you're never the same. It alters your life and you never think the same again. And I think John was rather excited by that prospect. I was rather frightened by that prospect. I thought, just what I need.
And so it was no surprise that when the Beatles released their next album at the end of that year, there was clearly a new influence. The lyrical themes on Rubber Soul were more mature and interesting, and their use of the studio was more inventive than any of their earlier records. Being a pop band was no longer about just going in the studio, hitting record, and running through a number of songs. Rubber Soul proved that a pop album could be a complete work of art, where every song was high quality. But for John, LSD had also given him the confidence to write about his own life, in a way that was more poetic and meaningful than before. Songwriting didn't have to be about producing these made-to-order love songs. It could be a way of looking deeper into one's own life. Nowhere Man is one of these, a song that is completely unrelated to love, just a purely retrospective look about John's newfound awareness.
Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to, isn't he a bit like you?
And of course, there is one of the most well-known songs that he ever wrote, In My Life. John was encouraged by others to not just write about the troubles that came with being in the Beatles, but also some deeper experiences from his childhood.
Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all.
John may have found the incessant fame and pressure of being in the Beatles too much, but his troubles likely stemmed from a much earlier time. Despite coming from the most financially comfortable background of the four Beatles, John's upbringing was certainly the most difficult. Born an only child in 1940, his father was away during much of his early life, before eventually losing contact altogether. His mother, Julia, remarried and, in John's words, couldn't cope with raising him. And so he was given over to be raised by his aunt, Mimi.
And John went to live with his uncle and auntie, and then the uncle died. And so John confided in me. He said, you know, I think I could be a jinx.
After getting closer to his mother, Julia, again in his teenage years, she was struck by a car and killed when John was just 17.
So even after his dad's left at three, his mother's got killed in front of the house he's now staying at, run over by a car. John did not have a great life in that department, in the family department.
But despite the distance between them, John's mother was the biggest influence on his music. She was supportive, she bought him his first guitar, shared records with him, and came along to many of his early shows. Meanwhile, his Aunt Mimi, who raised him, was much stricter, once saying, "The guitar's all right, John, but you'll never make a living out of it." Clearly, so much of John's music was an attempt to reconnect to his mother, and certainly his cry for help was really about his traumatic childhood. And LSD seemed to be the first thing that provided that link to his songwriting, but his continued use of the drug soon took him somewhere very different. It was becoming ever more clear that their intense schedule couldn't continue. In 1965, they recorded and released two albums, starred in a feature-length film, toured the UK, US, and Europe, and constantly gave press interviews and recorded promo films. They were exhausted.
I mean, it was great when it first happened. When you'd come on, there'd just be nothing but wah, you know? But then we just became like lip-syncing, you know, miming.
Their manager, Brian Epstein, had planned for the following year, 1966, to continue like before. But the Beatles vetoed this idea and instead took a few months off, the longest break they'd had in years. But the break did them good. In fact, it was in these few months that the Beatles changed more than any other time. Paul finally took LSD, the last of the four of them to do so, and became immersed in London's avant-garde scene. George got deep into Eastern spirituality, studying the sitar and Indian music. Ringo spent time with his wife and newly born child. And John? Well, John changed the most. Firstly, by using LSD even more heavily, he went beyond the heightened sense of consciousness that he first discovered, and almost to a place of losing one's ego. But he also became incredibly lazy. Journalist Maureen Cleave wrote that he was probably the laziest person in England. But something he did enjoy was reading. A favourite of the time was this, The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary. And whilst John was asleep most of the time, the rest of the world was just waking up to the possibilities of LSD. Figures like Timothy Leary were preaching to others about this higher form of consciousness.
We tell young people today, drop out of school, because schools, education today, is the worst narcotic drug of all. Don't politic, don't vote. These are old men's games, impotent and senile old men that want to put you onto their old chess games of war and power. Drop out.
When the Beatles returned to the studio after the break, they began as they usually did by recording one of John's songs. But this time, it was neither a cry for help nor a reflective, introspective song. Instead, it was a sound that shocked everybody. Recording for the new album began in April 1966. But when they entered the studio, they discovered one more change that they weren't expecting. They were assigned a new recording engineer, 20-year-old Jeff Emmerich. Unsure if he'd be up to the job, John introduced his new idea to both Jeff and producer George Martin. This one's completely different than anything we've ever done before. It's only got the one chord and the whole thing is meant to be like a drone. And I want my voice to sound like the Dalai Lama chanting from a mountaintop, miles away. Young Jeff Emmerich, who hadn't worked with the Beatles before, obviously had no idea what John was going on about. Firstly, he'd likely have no idea what John had been up to in the past few months, but even accepting that, they were still using such primitive equipment. There were no plugins and no effects. If they wanted to create a new sound, it would need to be physically created with the very limited tools they had available. And poor Jeff was only 20 years old. But luckily, they began by recording the rhythm track. The first step was to record a simple guitar loop of John with Ringo on drums. To get an otherworldly sound, they recorded this at a much faster tempo, drenched it in reverb, and then slowed the tape right down. They then played their parts over the top of this loop, and in take one you can hear George Martin telling them that the tape is about to start. Here it comes. The problem still remained of how to produce the vocal effect that John had requested.
So luckily for me, I was looking through the control room window and there was a revolving speaker, which is called the Leslie speaker that goes with the Hammond organ. So I thought, well, if we can cut into the circuitry and get John's voice to go into that speaker, and as it's revolving, it'll give us the sound we want. We put John's voice through it and it was just amazing, and he was just over the moon with it.
But this was just take one, and as they listened to the playback, further ideas started to emerge. George suggested that they use one of his newly acquired instruments, the tambora, which would be perfect for the drone sound. And it was Paul who suggested to Ringo a different drum part, tapping out a rhythm on the mixing desk, something similar to the rhythm used on Ticket to Ride. Jeff played around with the mics, breaking EMI studio rules to try and get an even more thunderous sound. And they all began on what was now the second take. 30 seconds in, somebody made a mistake and the take was scrapped. But on just the third take, they recorded the psychedelic masterpiece that we know today. They then added George's tambora and John's vocal.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not...
John and the rest of the Beatles were delighted with what they'd just recorded. George Martin called them into the control room to listen back, and they all agreed that this was exactly what they were after. The rhythm track was complete, and each of the Beatles were assigned the task to record some loops at home and bring them in the next day. Five of which are present in the final song. The loops were then arranged in a way that meant they played continuously, and then the four of them, as well as George and Jeff, turned the faders up and down throughout the song, playing the loop as an instrument over the mix.
These tapes are running and running and running, and the Beatles and my dad and Jeff Emmerich performed on the desk, pushing up faders at the right time in order to create the instrument sounds they wanted for the mix.
This song, more than anything else they would ever record, leapt the Beatles into the world of psychedelic music. And for John, it symbolised this incredible transformation he'd made from writing these early love songs into something that would change the world. John's other songs on Revolver continue to explore this psychedelic journey. There's Dr. Roberts, which many people believe is about the first LSD trip he had with George. I'm Only Sleeping, which of course is about his lazy lifestyle. And She Said, She Said, which is directly about an incident which occurred during John's second trip. She Said, She Said was the final song recorded for Revolver, and it should have bookended this incredible creative time for the group. But the recording is instead best remembered for a falling out. The exact reason of the falling out is unclear, or even whether Paul was involved at all. But on the last night of recording Revolver, Paul walked out of the session and left the other three to finish the song. As a result, it's one of the very few Beatles songs in which Paul doesn't feature at all. Revolver was a psychedelic masterpiece, and the incredible creativity, especially on John's songs, is in no doubt thanks to his use of LSD. But it was also becoming clear that the incredible benefits of the drug also came with terrible consequences. That summer, the Beatles finally retired from touring, helped in part by a dangerous incident in the Philippines after they turned down an invitation to meet with the First Lady, and there was John's comment in the US that they were now more popular than Jesus.
If it had said, television is more popular than Jesus, I might have got away with it.
But with no more concerts, each of the Beatles were able to spend more time on their own, developing their own interests and working on their own ideas, and still ultimately finding out who they were as individuals. For John, this lifestyle centered around his near constant use of LSD.
I must have had 1,000 trips.
Literally 1,000.
Oh yeah. No, lots, you know. I used to just eat it all the time.
John was now living with these two extremes of himself. One was this incredibly creative musical mind, and the other was a depressive, lazy personality. It seemed as though nothing, not even the success of the Beatles, could reconcile these two sides. But later that year, something happened that was probably the most impactful thing on his life since the death of his mother. John had been invited, or more accurately, lured into attending an art exhibition at the Indica Gallery in London. As a friend of the gallery, he was often invited along to private events before exhibitions were open to the public. John was expecting some provocative performance or exhibition, but instead he was greeted with a number of conceptual artworks. Although at first skeptical, there were a couple of pieces which intrigued him. Ceiling painting consisted of a single ladder looking up towards a canvas on the ceiling, and by using the accompanying magnifying glass, it was possible to see the word yes printed on the canvas. And there was another piece that he liked, Hammer and Nail. John, being John, took it upon himself to try hammering a nail into the artwork before the artist stopped him. The artist, of course, was Yoko Ono. Despite a pleasant first meeting, their relationship didn't develop much further. Both of them were still married to other people, but they kept in touch, and John even agreed to sponsor an art show that she was planning the following year. Yoko was different. She understood John in a way that nobody else did, and likely in a way that John didn't even understand himself. Because for now, John was still caught between these two extremes of LSD. The creative side of him was clear for all to see. What followed was a run of songs with the Beatles that exemplified psychedelic music. It began with Strawberry Fields Forever, a song that he wrote about a home close to where he lived growing up, with a production style perhaps even more hypnotic than Tomorrow Never Knows. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Then came the Sgt. Pepper album, perhaps the album that sits at the top of the psychedelic mountain. Songs like Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, a song entirely about a circus, with an incredible production of circus sounds. There's also Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And A Day in the Life, which many people consider a magnum opus of the Beatles, a highly inventive and beautifully constructed song that combines these two contrasting ideas written by John and Paul. And then came perhaps the most abstract song that the Beatles ever released, I Am the Walrus. I don't think there has ever been a more consistent, creative, and impactful run of songs in the history of popular music, all within the space of 12 months. And of course it wasn't just thanks to John, but all four of the Beatles and their continued work with George Martin and Jeff Emerick. But once again, on the inside, everything wasn't as it seemed. Last time it was Beatlemania that John couldn't escape, and this time it was LSD.
And I destroyed myself, you know. And then I destroyed my ego, you know, and I didn't believe I could do anything, you know. And I let Paul do what he wanted and say them all just do what they wanted, and I just was nothing, I was shit, you know.
John had now gone full circle. What started as a cry for help, a way to write music that was more personal, had forced him to yet again confront why he started in the first place.
The basic thing nobody asked is why do people take drugs of any sort, from alcohol to aspirins to hard drugs? And that question has to be resolved first before you think, well, what can we do for the poor drug addict?
If John was to stop taking LSD, he'd need to address two things. What made him start in the first place, and to find something of genuine value to replace his dependency on the drug. The reason he started, of course, was the death of his mother, Julia, and all the other trauma that took place in his childhood. Thankfully for John, the perfect person had entered his life to offer him the genuine hope that drugs could only appear to. John was still married and living with his wife, Cynthia, but it was clear that John and Yoko's relationship was slowly developing, and she was having an immense impact on his life. John finally stopped taking LSD in 1968, the year after Sgt. Pepper was released. As John put it, he got the message and hung up the phone. And this time he would approach everything directly. Along with the other three Beatles, John spent the early part of 1968 in India. It was just like the early days. Writing songs with the only instrument they had, an acoustic guitar. Reminiscent of those early days in Liverpool, writing songs on the guitar that his mother bought for him. The album that came from that time was this, the White Album. It covers the width and breadth of the Beatles' different styles. But there's one song on here, written by John, that's very different.
Half of what I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia.
It's the only song the Beatles ever recorded that is only John and his guitar. Nothing and nobody else. And it's a song he wrote for his mother, Julia. The first time in years that he'd written a song so meaningful and reflective. The song also references Ocean Child, the English meaning of Yoko. It was Yoko that gave him the hope that neither fame nor money, and especially nor drugs, could ever offer him.
People that take drugs, it means they've got no hope. The only time I ever took drugs was when I had no hope. And when you're on drugs, it's harder to find hope, and you're too far gone before you find out you're really hooked. And you've got to have hope, and if we can give people hope, then they won't need drugs.
When John returned to England, he invited Yoko to stay at his house, and they started their relationship.
It's called love, but that's the secret, you know. It's all true, folks. All you need is love. It's like anything, you sing about it first or write about it first and find out what you were talking about after.